Good morning. I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Business and Labor. Looks like we have three bills on the agenda. I am going to go just a little bit out of order because it will take very little time. And so with that, I'm going to go open up House Bill 4121. Jan, give us a brief description of House Bill 4121.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure maintains the current dispute resolution process at the Construction Contractors Board that would otherwise be replaced in 2017 with the process used prior to 2011. And no mention of the amendment, right?
Yeah, we're not going to do it.
There on the original bill, there's no revenue impact and there's no fiscal impact, and there is.
And why?
Okay, excuse me. So on the committee was discussing a dash one amendment. The chair was looking at that. Then we were receiving note from fiscal and revenue that they wanted to see the bill, but we are only moving the committee is considering moving the original bill, which does not have a referral to Ways and Means. Sorry for the confusion.
Whew.
Yeah.
Jim. Oh.
Present.
Jim. Would you introduce yourself for the record? Sorry for the informality.
Good morning, Representative Holvey, members of the committee. Jim Denno, the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. I want to thank you for taking the time to look at House Bill 4121 today. Just to put this into context for you a little bit, probably many of you are aware of some of the tribulations of the CCB over the last couple of years. Some key staff left the agency and a whole new management team was hired. I was brought in about 18 months ago, and the board's direction has been to kind of take a back-to-basics approach for the agency, really focus on strategic planning, being more transparent, working with our stakeholders, focusing on our core mission of licensing standards enforcement and public protection. So this particular bill relates to our dispute resolution process. And just to give you a little background here, the CCB has operated a dispute resolution service to help owners, customers, and contractors resolve disputes that sometimes arise in construction projects. This is, by the way, residential only. This program serves residential. And the old process involved a contested case process with the Office of Administrative Hearings. And in 2011, the agency was facing a sizable budget shortfall between the 2007 and 2013. We lost about 20% of the licensees from the construction industry. So licensing numbers and revenues were down. So in order to streamline the agency and make some cuts, a new process for dispute resolution was crafted. And in this process, CCB focuses on the mediation. So we get a mediator out there with an owner and a contractor, and they try to mediate a resolution. And our mediators are very skilled. We have a pretty good success rate there. If no settlement is agreed upon, then the parties can go to court. And then a court judgment is brought back to the CCB, and the contractor or the contractor's surety is responsible to make payment. So this change in the law took place in 2011. At that time, the thinking of the agency was that within 5 years or so, the economy would be back, the licensing numbers, and hence the revenue would be back to return to the old process. Well, we're a long way from that. I don't know if you have the materials in front of you, but you can see that our licensing numbers finally bottomed out, but they have not increased significantly since then. So we don't have the revenue to fund a return to the old process. But what we discovered in the meantime was that the new process was actually more effective at reaching resolutions of these disputes. We have a higher success rate in mediating disputes in the new process. We have committed with to our stakeholders to have discussions about this program and how we might further enhance it and make it more effective yet. But in the meantime, we don't want to see the sunset take effect and the old law return. Everyone agrees that that would not serve the public as well as the current law. So what we're asking for is a repeal of the sunset provision, which would take us back to the old way of doing business. And that will allow us time to work with our stakeholders and see if we have a better process even than the one we have now going forward. So that's what we're asking you for in this bill.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So this bill isn't really changing the existing law that around this program. It's just taking the sunset off.
Chair Holby, that's correct. It doesn't make any changes to the existing law.
And just a comment for the record, I hope that when you're reviewing this process, you engage with the state bar so that they're aware that you're looking at this. They were, they're looking at some of the administrative law process changes. And so it would make me happy if you engaged with them on that.
Chair Holby, we'll be sure and do that.
Well, I don't know if happy is the right word, but thank you. Are there any questions on this? Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. Is there anybody else wanting to speak to this bill? Thank you.
Excuse me. Do we still continue to do some of the mediation under this when we revert to the old program?
If we reverted to the old program, yes, we continue to do mediation.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
But we're not reverting to the old program. We're continuing the existing one.
Thank you. That's a better way to say it. Thank you. Excuse me.
All right. Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4121 and open up work session. House Bill 4121. Sim Burton,
Chair,
to the floor.
Chair Holby, I move House Bill 4121 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 4121 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Ashley, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Winder?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnamer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 4121, having received the votes, passed. Carriers.
I'll take it.
Representative Esquivel.
Great.
That'll close the work session, House Bill 4121, and open a work session on, open a public hearing. Just jumping ahead of myself. On House Bill 4086. Jim, could you please review the bill for us?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure provides temporary lockout benefits that are equal to an individual's most recently received weekly unemployment benefit claim for any individual who is unemployed during a labor lockout. It caps the temporary lockout benefit at 26 times the weekly benefit amount of an individual's most recent unemployment claim. It requires an employer to be charged with the temporary lockout benefits in the same manner that regular benefits are charged. It allows payment for the temporary benefits to be made retroactively, declares an emergency. There's no amendment for you. There are fiscal and revenue statements issued that are on OLIS, or if anyone needs a hard copy, we have that here. They came in rather late. And there is a subsequent referral on this bill to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Good morning. Sorry for the short wait. I was trying to save the state a little money by getting him back to work.
That's good.
That was artful, excuse me. That was nice. That was good.
That was artful.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Can you imagine? Dan Rayfield, House District 16.
Ron Rogers, United Steelworkers Staff Representative.
State Senator Sarah Gelster from Corvallis, Albany, Philomath.
And would you like to go first?
I would, Mr. Chair, because unfortunately my other chair is going to harm me if I don't get to committee soon to vote. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelster. I'm the state senator from Corvallis, Fallon, within Albany. If you look in the room behind me, you see a number of the people in my district. These are the people of my district who want to go to work. They wake up every morning and they want to go to work. Their employer is not allowing them to go to work, and their unemployment benefits are about to run out. I am so grateful to Representative Rayfield for leading the charge and doing the footwork on this work. It's the least that we can do for these folks. I'm listening to them, hearing from them about the challenges, paying mortgages, buying shoes for kids. This extension of unemployment benefits is essential for these hardworking people that have been devoted to their employer for as many as 20 or 30 years. They want to work. We need to do everything we can to help them. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And will you excuse me if I go to committee?
Yes, I suppose so. Thank you so much for coming over and starting us off.
Thank you so
Have
much.
Have a good day. And introduce yourself for the record, please, again.
With pleasure. Dan Rayfield, House District 16, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. I often don't get the privilege of having so many people at my committee hearings as you guys apparently get, and especially in the Ways and Means process for some reason. If you listen very quietly, the one thing you're not going to hear, which is surprising to me because I have a 4.5-year-old, is there's even Sam, who's 6 years old. Sam, you want to wave? And then we have Zibby, who's 3 years old, quiet in the back here, that's also in support of what we're doing here today. The bill before you essentially extends unemployment benefits for locked-out workers from 6 months to 12 months. The current law is that we do provide unemployment benefits for locked out workers for 6 months. Locked out workers, just to clarify again, are folks that want to work but are unable to work because their employer has refused to allow them to work during a labor negotiation. The current law is part of the reason it's in place is because locked out workers are very unique, and you're going to hear a lot of testimony about this, about why they're unique and why we provide unemployment benefits for them. Locked out workers are folks that they have families. They need to provide for their families, and so they try and look for work because unemployment benefits, quite frankly, are not to the level that your regular employment is. And so when they go out and look for work, the interesting thing that you're going to hear about and that you find is it's very difficult because other employers in the community don't want to hire you because you are going to return to your original place of employment because that's where your benefits are vested. That's where you have a job that often pays a wage that you can't find in the community. So this idea came about because, as Senator Gelser mentioned, there's 180 folks that are locked out in Albany, the steelworkers, the folks that you see behind me today. And they're going to come up and they're going to tell you about some of these issues. What I want to do, and they're going to tell about it much better than I could ever do, but what I want to do is go some of the little technical details on the fiscal and kind of somewhat anticipate some of the questions that you might have. This bill has a small fiscal of $53,000, which is why you see the referral to the Ways and Means process. That is because the unemployment department must go through and update their computer system, as well as there's some reporting requirements to the federal side. This is a one-time issue that you'll see in the fiscal. There is no ongoing fiscal going into the 2017-19 biennium. Additionally, this does have an impact to the unemployment trust fund balance during the current fiscal year, 15-16, half of the year. If the unemployed folks get benefits for the full 12 months, it will impact it by $1.9 million. To put that into perspective, one of the things that all of us would want to know is this going to raise rates for employers? And I asked this question directly from the unemployment department. I asked them if it was okay if I could share the information that they provided in an email to me. They said yes. To put it into context, the current trust fund balance when they were looking at the rates in 2016 had a balance of $2.76 billion. I think that's an important distinction. And now, while it's impossible, and what they said, it's impossible to give a 100% solid answer to the question, they said it is unlikely that these payouts, even if there are ongoing lockouts, would trigger our being in a higher tax schedule next year. So I think that's very important, that it's extremely unlikely that it would increase expenses to other employers. The other thing that I would note is Representative Andy Olson would have been here today, but he's with family today. This is a bipartisan bill. You can look at the folks that are signed on to it. This is a bill that was meant for a short session like this. This is a bill that will have an immediate impact on the 180 locked out workers. This is a bill that if we don't do anything, they will lose their benefits within the month. So.
Okay, and Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Ron Rogers. I have been a staff representative with the United Steelworkers for a little over 5 years. I service the ATI location in Albany as well as numerous other locations throughout Oregon and Washington. Prior to working full-time for the USW, I worked as a millwright for about 15 years in the actual facility that's currently on lockout. So I've known these people throughout my career. The current lockout is a nationwide lockout affecting 2,200 workers in 12 different states. Over 99% of all contract negotiations end successfully without a labor dispute. Strikes and lockouts are very rare. However, when they occur, they're often well covered by the media, so they may appear to be more common than they actually are. Strikes are always considered a last resort by unions. They occur when the membership votes on an issue that they feel is important enough to take action on. As such, affected employees in a strike do have a choice in the matter. If the vote does not pass, the strike does not happen. And further, while not encouraged, if a local is on strike, the member has the choice to cross the picket line and continue working. In a lockout, no one is allowed to work. Even if a member would be willing to cross, they're not able to do so. So really, they have absolutely no choice. In a lockout, they have no control over the situation whatsoever. Lockouts are extremely rare. In my time with the USW, I've negotiated about 50 contracts, and none of those contracts, frankly, have resulted in a strike or a lockout. Lockouts are a hardball tactic that can be employed by an employer. By denying the worker income, it makes it more likely that they'll accept major concessions from the employer. This is especially true the longer the members are out. Even with unemployment benefits, many families struggle to make ends meet, and once the benefits expire, the pressure will become much higher. The company continues to operate with out-of-state workers that they house in local hotels. While we don't have the exact data, we're told by some management that has given us some information that the cost of replacement workers is even higher than what they were paying our original workers, our members that are locked out. The tactic is harmful to the community because the wages that are earned by the replacement workers from out of state aren't being spent in the community, but they're being sent home to their families in whatever state they came from. It's important to note that the workers in the facility in Albany have worked collaboratively in the past with the company. Over the last two contracts, they've taken concessions in health care. They've taken cuts to their pension. They recognize that it's important to keep the company viable, and when reasonable cuts are requested, they've met with those requests in the past. Unfortunately, now there's about 200 workers locked out who are willing and able to continue to work. As these workers are faced with incredibly difficult decisions, like you'll hear about in a moment, the clock is ticking on their modest unemployment. We have about 10 days left before that's not available to them anymore. A few have found other jobs and so are not on unemployment anymore. I don't have the exact numbers, but we've probably had about 15 to 20 that have taken their retirement, and probably at least another 20 to 30 that have found suitable employment. But we still have many that have not been able to do so. So when a worker in Oregon is willing and able to work but is kept from doing so by an employer using these extreme tactics and putting more pressure on them, we should as a state take modest steps to ease the economic burden that they will face. Thank you for your attention to this issue and allowing me to present.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. A question, not even for this panel, maybe for you, Chair Holvey or Vice Chair Kenemer. You guys are good sources of institutional knowledge. strikes, they're rare, but they happen from time to time. I don't even know if I've heard of a lockout before this one. Does anyone remember a major lockout in the state of Oregon?
I think there's been one or two, but they didn't last
very long. This is like a once a decade kind of thing.
Decades ago.
And Representative Barton, we actually looked at some of that historical data of when lockouts do happen. And I should say the AFL went back and historically looked at how often. It is extremely rare that you have a lockout over 6 months. It is unusual. Obviously, and that's why I think when the initial unemployment benefits were given to locked out workers, nobody really thought about doing anything past 6 months. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the reasons you see in the fiscal for the impact of the trust fund is going on years after this. It's indeterminate because it happens so rare that we can't answer that question. So
I have never heard of it.
Well, Representative, maybe as a clarification follow up with that is that lockouts are not may I be recognized? Lockouts by employers are not used for employment reasons. They're used for one reason alone, and that is to break a union. That's the only time they use it for. So
Representative Kinnemer.
I had a little tiny bit of time to do a little research. If I understand correctly, lockout benefits were extended for the first time in Oregon's history in 2007. Is that correct?
I believe that's accurate.
Okay. And the legislature did it at that point. So it's been unprecedented, and then it was done for 6 months, and I don't know the legislative history of why that period of time was selected.
Representative Kinnemer, I think as you'll hear, the impact of folks and their families when they lose the income is, I think, the real impetus for why this was such an important thing to do.
Representative Hurd?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you, by any chance, have a list of some of the concessions you guys have had to make over the last couple years or so?
I don't have an exact list. I do know that they increased co-pays in health care. Their pension isn't a multi-employer pension thing. It's kind of it's a different animal from your standard pension. It's just taken major reductions to keep the pension viable. I know there's been cuts over the last several contracts on vacations. These members have taken concessions, again, to recognizing that there are cost increases, and they do the best that they can within reason. To help absorb some of those costs.
And Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, I would also note that that's part of the reason that Representative Olson got on board with this, and that's why this is bipartisan, is because he recognized, being the representative in that area, that these folks have really tried to work to get an agreement. These are folks that want to work. They have families. This is really important. And when the lockout benefits expire in 10 days, this is going to have dramatic impacts, as you will hear, on their families.
Follow up. Is it possible to elaborate on what the current dispute is that's hanging this up from getting them back to work? Is there any one or two?
It's not really one or two issues. I mean, it's a collection of issues. And keep in mind, too, that this is the Albany local is involved with it. It's 22 locals across 6 different states, 12 different locals. And the way it works is they're in what's called a coterminous agreement. So they all negotiate at the same time. And while their contracts may not be identical, there's some that are identical, frankly, and some that may just have pieces that are similar to each other. And then the entire coalition, I guess, votes up or down is one vote. But the issues are relatively similar across, primarily health care. I mean, that's always a big one. Mm-hmm. And again, the members and the members behind me are not strangers to taking cuts in health care. And I would even go as far as to say is I don't think that if a reasonable package was submitted to them that they wouldn't be reasonable again. But the cuts in their health care program are draconian. It takes them back. I would argue that the value of their health care would be less than the average in the nation. It's HSA, high out-of-pocket, high deductible, and that's just one aspect. I could probably spend half an hour talking about all the requested cuts, but requesting cuts to vacation that they've already taken cuts and caps on before, requesting to contract out jobs without any kind of real thresholds on it. literally their language pretty much said, we'll contract out whatever we want to, whenever we want to. That wasn't the exact language, but that's, I mean, this might as well what it had been translated into. I mean, there's other issues beyond that. I mean, those are just a handful of the very key issues. And if you look at other contract negotiations where there's similar issues, and like I said, I negotiate all kinds of different locations, even though this is the home location they came out of. I mean, companies may ask for cuts in healthcare, may ask for cuts or relief in contracting out. And it's given a lot, frankly, especially in our day and age with manufacturing going overseas and the loss of manufacturing jobs across the country. Our members are not strangers to taking concessions when they make sense and they don't just gut everything that you've worked for through the past 30 years.
And Representative Colby Reves heard, I think the important thing to remember is that when we negotiate in America, we negotiate from equal ground, mm-hmm. right? And that's the way that we want to approach each other. This is a situation where folks are losing their benefits and in 10 days, I mean, less than a month that they're going to be out of. These are folks that want to work. These are folks with families, folks that are unable to get other jobs through the situation. Where they try and get alternative employment and they're unable to, that's the lens that we're looking through this. This isn't about negotiations. This is about making sure that these families have the benefits that they need. And quite frankly, even with unemployment benefits, as you will hear, they are making substantial sacrifices in their lives to take care of their families, to take care of themselves. And it's only going to get worse if we don't extend these benefits.
Representative Nose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if you could tell the committee how the employer is doing financially.
I know that, I believe, don't quote me on the exact numbers, but I know ballpark, the last quarter was a $229 million loss. The quarter before that was a $150 million loss. And a significant portion of that is contributed to the lockout. And that's aren't numbers that we derive. That's the company's own admission. $50 million of that in the quarter before last, and I'm honestly not sure of the number of that in the most recent quarter. The company has taken a hit, but it's a self-inflicted hit for a big majority of that. Well, I don't know about majority, but a large portion. That's ties directly to the cost of the lockout. Now, there's also hidden costs of the lockout that's not reported in that number, which is, frankly, replacement workers aren't going to do as well of a job as far as cost effectiveness and production effectiveness as someone that's been doing those jobs for 20 to 30 years, which every single one of our members at the Ormet facility literally has 20-plus years of service in that location, except for maybe a handful of maintenance people. These are people that have dedicated their lives to this company and contributed to, not just the Albany area, but many of our members live in Salem and outlying areas. They've contributed to their communities for decades, frankly.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Follow up.
Thank you. I want to ask, it was kind of the question I wanted, it wasn't exactly the question I wanted you to answer, but it was interesting. What was the financial health of the corporation before they decided to lock you out?
ATI has always been a very strong company. They're still a strong company, frankly. They're a major player in the titanium sector and stainless steel market. They've financed a $1.2 billion expansion project in Brackenridge, Pennsylvania. And most of the expansions that they do are paid for with cash without having to borrow money. They're also doing a major expansion in the city of Albany at their non-union location on Queen Street, which has a projected cost to it, don't quote me, but I believe something in the range of $150 million. That number may be off. I'm not exactly clear on that one. But yes, even with their recent losses, they are very well funded. They are not looking at any kind of financial distress.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So
Representative Doherty said that the purpose for the lockout is basically to break the union. And I don't know a lot about union labor negotiations, things like that. But the strike is the leverage from the employee side. The lockout then would be the leverage from the employer side. If you take away that leverage by giving more unemployment, then is that an unfair treatment to the employer? I mean, that, you know, I'm trying to get a grasp of this. And if their purpose was, you just said they had a non-union shop in Albany, and then they have a union shop also?
Yes.
So they already have the two different businesses, and I'm wondering if their purpose, if indeed Representative Doherty's objective is for them to go non-union, is that one of the things on the table, is can you just go non-union and go back to work?
So what I would say, you know, in Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, I think the focus of this is not on negotiations. There's a lot other elements to this that we could get into that I'm trying to not, for instance, the NLRB context and things like that. This bill is really about helping the folks that are on unemployment, making sacrifices already. The leverage has already been put there. What you have to understand, you will hear in the testimony that comes up here, the leverage has already been applied. And it is, I think it's going to be striking for you. The leverage is already there. This is about, I mean, really taking, I mean, this is, you'll hear the testimony. I won't use hyperbole to describe what the impact will be when these benefits run out. But the leverage is already there. These folks are already feeling it. And I think what we believe, you know, is, as Americans, is that we should be able to negotiate, come together in good faith on both sides by not using, you know, extreme levers on either side, to be able to come to what we would consider a good contract. And that's what these folks in Albany have done. That's what these steelworkers have done, and that's why this is a bipartisan bill. You know, that's why Representative Andy Olson and others are looking at this and saying, you know what, these are good guys. These are folks that have families. These are hard workers, and we need to help them because their benefits are running out.
Follow up.
Chair Holvey, if I may expand on that, and I know we're trying to keep the focus on the livability of the people that are affected, but in response to your question, Representative Barreto, I don't think it takes away the company's tools, if that's how you want to phrase it. In fact, if anything, I think it gives them an unfair advantage, because these people are looking at literally losing houses that they've worked their whole life to gain. They're looking at losing everything they've spent the past 20 to 30 years to build. On a strike, the company, people that work for the company, aren't looking at any kind of consequences like that, nothing even remotely similar. So these are life-altering circumstances for these people. Secondly, I think it's important to note, and it's a little bit off in the weeds as well, but there were NLRB charges filed against the company for their actions taken during negotiations, actions that were in violation of the National Labor Relations Act. There has been merit found in the case. The company is in negotiations with the international leadership in the with the USW at this point. Nothing fruitful has come out of that. That's expected to go to an official complaint sometime this month. But even if it does, there's still a whole appeals process and everything else that has to go through that's going to take much longer than these people have before they ran out of unemployment insurance.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Oh, did you have a follow-up?
Well, actually, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did hear this case, I think, in the last session, and I remember the testimony, and it was there were some heart-wrenching stories, and I think all of us wished it would have been resolved and we didn't have to go through this again. I agree with that. No, my thinking was when you get into a labor situation like this, and also, you know, you cover two states, it seems like it's at a national level. What happens to these people out here is not based on a local decision that is made. It's based on something that happens at a higher level. Am I correct in that?
Respectfully, no. Although there's attempted movement that's done at the higher level, that movement's done at the direction of the membership, and anything that is done would eventually have to be voted on, including by the people from Albany. So, I mean, they do have control of it. It's this kind of, I guess for lack of a better way to phrase it, it's a bit of a cost-saving issue, because the way it is set up, the negotiations take place in Pittsburgh. So to have everybody there at this point would be an extreme burden, not just because of the cost of flying everybody out there, putting them up in hotels and going to these meetings, but also, frankly, the time away from their families if they're back there for 2 to 3 to 4 months as these protract out on and on and on. And so we have representatives at a higher level that are trying to hash out some of the more extreme issues, if you will. The plan is if they can get to a point where that's viable and they do keep us somewhat in the loop of what's going on and where the movement has been and whether it's been meaningful. And when it gets to a point to where it looks like it's going to be viable that we're going to be able to come to some sort of a resolution, then the plan is to send the entire committees back to do that, those final negotiations. But, I mean, like at this point, there's been meetings that are sporadic that have gone on over the past 3 months. It would just be unreasonable to expect to have basically 60 different people from the negotiating teams all merged in Pittsburgh over the past 3 months period. So that's why it kind of operates the way it does at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at this, and this is going to go beyond us at this level. I mean, we'll just move this bill out of here. And there's a lot of legal stuff that needs to happen and take place. And I feel for everybody out here that's suffering from being on strike and being locked out. So I think when we're doing this and when you're reaching out to the company in these negotiations, one of the things we always try to do is say, we have X dollars basically for salaries, and sit down, how do we want it as employees? Do we want it as salary? Do we want it as benefits? Things like that. But if the numbers are true and they're losing as much money because of this location, like you say, even if we're able to get the benefits extended and it's kind of to everybody out here, you need to be looking for work elsewhere. I feel bad for Albany. You lost the paper mill. I mean, we're running industry out of the state, and that pays the kind of wages that you guys make and find jobs like that, it's hard to do in the state. So I would say go to the table, find out what they're willing to pay, and then figure a way to get it negotiated quickly, because if you're not able to get it done, you guys need to really be looking for work someplace else if they're losing that kind of money, because they'll probably shut the plant down completely is what they're looking at with the losses. So just a comment. You can respond if you want to, but I don't want to, 6 months after we do this, we're right back here again having to do this again for them because they're still locked out or whatever. They're planning on just closing the doors. You need to take care of your families, and you need to be aggressive about taking care of your families. And if you're being treated this way by this company and this is going on, there's lots of other companies out there to look for to feed your family with. So.
Representative Doherty.
Okay.
Would you like to respond?
Well, I can respond to.
I knew you probably would.
Representative Widener and Barreto. And I think this comes from experience. I've bargained well over 100 collective bargaining agreements, you know, over a 20-year period. But the one thing that has not been brought out is that we have the National Labor Relations Board, and they go through, and if private sector unions have a complaint or management, they file a complaint with the NLRB. And the NLRB ruled the actions on the part of ATI were illegal. And part of the ruling that came out from Washington was that they had actually begun planning a lockout before they ever sat down at the bargaining table. And one of the major components of bargaining is that you're supposed to, through whether it's the Employment Relations Board here in Oregon for public sector or private sector, you're supposed to negotiate in a sincere manner. And I've had instances where, you know the very first 37 minutes you sit down at a bargaining table whether you're going to have very rough bargaining because of the way that the proposals are presented. So I think that that's something that's very important making this decision, is to realize that the National Labor Relations Board has ruled that the actions on the part of ATI are illegal, especially when they were looking at, I can't call them replacement workers because they're not, is that they were planning all of this before you ever sit down and bargain, and so that's why they went through and ruled that they were not, that the management was not bargaining in good faith. So every, trust me, every union sits down, they don't sit there and say, oh, how can we go through and, you know, make things really hard for us and our workers? They don't do that. They go through and they very, very carefully and very sincerely look at what management's proposals are. They look at what the health of the company is. They look at the health of the region and all that. And then they come through with proposals. And so I think it's very important to look at the NLRB decision.
Thank you. And I really want to, we've asked a lot of questions, used up a lot of time. We got some other people here that need to testify, and I got a long line. And, you know, I think Representative Doherty said what I was going to say. I'm so glad you didn't call them scabs, those replacement workers. So with that.
Written down.
So with that, I would like to bring up, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have one more question.
Oh, well, you have one more question?
Sure.
Because I thought you already asked a question. So, but go ahead. Is it a quick one?
Yeah. We've talked about leverage either side. What can you give me kind of a number of what the percentage of, so say somebody's getting paid $4,000 a month when they're working, but with the unemployment benefits that you're receiving right now that you want an extension on, what kind of value, what is it 40%, 50%, 60% of what their normal pay would be?
Of their previous income?
Yes.
I mean, it really depends on the individual job and also the individual and how much overtime they worked.
Ballpark.
And actually, let me step in, Chair Holby, Representative Hurd. There's actually going to be members who will have it, and you can actually directly ask them, and I think that'll give you real concrete data on that.
Thank you, Representative Rayfield. Thank you, Mr. Rogers.
Thank you.
And I just want to remember, Sam and Zibby have been entirely quiet throughout this entire hearing.
But Sam's been glaring at me like crazy.
I might note they have been quieter than we have.
Mr. Chair.
So up next I have, glasses. Jessica Giannantino, Steve Adams, Barry Grant, and Josh Hall.
Mr. Chair, as they come up, just for the record, the so-called scabs, they're people and citizens that are trying to feed their families as well.
I called them scabs.
You didn't call them scabs.
I said I was happy she didn't call them scabs, is what I said. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Giannantino, and I'm representing the Oregon AFL-CIO today. The Oregon AFL-CIO is a statewide federation of unions representing 300,000 workers throughout the state, and we're a voice for all workers in the legislative process. We're clearly here this morning to discuss the current lockout that's affecting Oregon workers in a particular community, and thanks to Representative Rayfield for bringing these issues forward before you today. I'm here to provide some context and a broad overview of the lockouts in the workplace that happen during a labor dispute. How can they occur and how they're used by employers? Work stoppages that include both lockouts and strikes happen rarely. I think we've heard that. But in the past decade, there's been an average of fewer than two dozen work stoppages per year nationally. And lockouts occur even less frequently, with about six lockouts on record across the country in 2015. Of the lockouts in 2015, three have ended and three continue, with an average duration of approximately 6 months. While lockouts do not happen every day, they can be devastating for families, as you'll hear, and the communities in which they take place. Imagine having every intention of going to work, but being able to do so, losing out on the needed family support income, and having only 6 months of modest unemployment insurance. Not to mention, as you'll hear about later, the challenges of being forced to decide if seeking seeking employment elsewhere and often having to take a significant pay cut if you're able to find employment while in the middle of a labor dispute. It's worth noting the difference between lockouts and strikes. Sometimes they get used synonymously, but they're very different. These two terms often... lockouts occur when an employer decides that employees should stop working, sometimes by physically barring them from their jobs. As you've heard, the legislature has grappled with the issue of locked-out workers before in 2007, when we did decide to extend unemployment insurance to workers who find themselves in this unfortunate situation. It's worth noting that that was a strong bipartisan initiative. Unfortunately, a lot of those representatives who were on the Republican side then are no longer here today, but we're excited to have Representative Olson and Representative Gilliam both on this bill. It's unfortunate to see an employer use this type of relatively rare tactic, especially when most of their desired leverage comes from pushing workers onto unemployment insurance, which is a public benefit, and then pushing the lockout duration beyond the workers' benefit eligibility. But when they do and these situations arise, the legislature has proven that it can make minor changes in statute that can have a major impact on working families. We appreciate you taking a look at these issues surrounding the locked-out workers and finding ways to ease this unfortunate burden that they're currently facing. Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Steve Adams, and I am currently a locked-out worker. As a locked-out worker, I would like to give you a firsthand account of how employers can negatively affect the lives of workers by using these types of tactics. Some employers do the right thing by their workers, and everyone thrives. But other employers are using lockouts as a way to reduce costs, deceptively leveraging groups of workers to accept concessions and force families into life-altering situations. For me personally, going from a livable wage job to unemployment was difficult. I could not imagine how devastating losing unemployment would be after a six-month benefit period. 5 years ago, I went through a divorce and just recently remarried. I am ordered to provide financial and medical coverage as part of that separation, which means I am currently the sole income source for both families. Try to imagine living with that stress every day of losing over half your income, causing you to juggle which bills to pay on a weekly basis. Do you get your daughter's prescription, or do you get a bag of groceries? Next, after 6 months of being locked out, you lose your unemployment insurance. Ours is set to expire February 15th, just 10 days from now. Some employers even cut health care benefits to their workers during a lockout like mine did to put even more pressure on us as workers. Now you have lost not only your health insurance, but your remaining source of income. If you don't think that's stressful enough, I have a son who has special needs, and that is what companies are counting on. Can they force you to give up everything, your house, your car, your quality of life, for their financial gain? And that's why it is so important to consider what you can do as a legislator to ease the incredibly difficult situation that a locked out worker like me, one that is ready and willing to work every day, could be once the unemployment benefits run out. By considering some remedies to these types of situations through the unemployment insurance program, it would go a long way to giving someone like me a chance to find a new place of employment, which is not easy because most employers don't want to hire you if you're in a labor dispute. In conclusion, it's everyone's goal to work hard for a living, give your heart and your soul to your employer, and eventually reach retirement with some dignity for the career that you've given to a craft. But when employers are allowed to abuse the system for their financial gain off the backs of their workers instead of the profits of their products, it's morally wrong. I hope that you will do everything you can to at least ease the suffering that workers who are ready and willing to work will face after their unemployment benefit period runs out.
Chair Holbley and members of the committee, my name is Barry Duran. I was asked to share with you guys how this has affected me and my family. Well, August 14th was payday for us. Little did I know that it may be my last from ATI. Plus, it was the same day that ATI decided to lock us out of work. It just so happened to be my wife's birthday weekend also. Mm. We were heading to Las Vegas for 5 days. That is how I started what was supposed to be a relaxing week with my wife. but instead it was the beginning of a very stressful and difficult time. It has added a measurable amount of stress to my life. I mean, how could it not? I've lost more than 60% of my income overnight. My wife has had to start working more hours to make up for the loss of my income. She is now having to work 10 to 12 hours a day, which has put a strain on our marriage. I've had to figure out how to juggle my finances, stealing from Peter to pay Paul just to keep my head above water, with the constant thought of how long am I going to be able to keep doing this? What's going to happen when I can't make the mortgage payment anymore? Do I find an RV park so that we can live in our trailer? Should I surrender my truck to the bank and spend that money on other things? But if I do that, then my credit takes a serious hit, that I'll have to pay twice as much for the same truck when I get back on my feet. At this point, I hope that I don't get injured or have to go to the ER. The last thing I need now is a huge medical bill. What if ATI loses contracts or orders and they no longer need all 180 of us when we turn back to work? Then what do I do? This is what goes through my mind almost on a daily basis. I haven't been able to find other employment. I believe it's because of whom I list as my employer, ATI. I have a one-year certification in non-destructive testing, which is a testing of metals that includes x-rays, ultrasound, diet-penetrant testing. There's a local employer that is currently hiring for these positions. I've applied with them several times, but I can't even get an interview. That local employer is the ATI non-union shop on Queen Street. I've worked in the metal industry for the past 11 years. I'm just scared that securing meaningful employment at my age is going to prove most difficult.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Josh Hall, and I would like to share my perspective with you in working with the nearly 180 locked out members. The stories that you hear from Steve and Barry are not unique. There are a lot of members that are going through similar type of things, just the stress that the whole lockout causes on the members and their families. For example, we have one member that is very physically fit, and in looking at him, you would never know that he was had a problem with diabetes. Since the lockout, his levels have been all over the place. He's been having a very hard time keeping those in check, as well as prescription medications, maintenance medications. Some of the members are looking at thousands of dollars per month just in their maintenance medication costs. And then the whole problem with trying to get employment at a livable wage job when a lot of the employers don't want to hire you because they're not sure how long you stay. We've had one member I can talk about that they applied for a job. It was going well. They really were interested in them. And at the end of the interview, you know, asked them if they were planning on going back. And their response, I mean, I think everybody wants to try to be truthful with the employers, and they said it would be hard not to. You know, they've got 20 years vested. They're about 4 or 5 years from retirement. And so, you know, that would be a big decision when it came, but, you know, they would probably go back. We had another member that was looking at a job working for Oregon State University. Same thing, interview was going very well. She thought for sure she was going to get the job. Obviously, at the end again, you know, she wanted to let them know that she was a member that was locked out in the labor dispute. She said you could just tell from that point, you know, their whole facial expression changed. They were very disappointed. And then she got the call the next day that that they were going to select somebody else. So 6 months, I think, is a very short window to try to find a livable wage job, especially when you couple that with reluctance that employers have, you know, to spend the time and money and resources to train somebody that they don't know will stay there for a week, a month, a year, so on. And so it makes it very difficult. So I just want to thank you guys. I think that the minimum, adding another 6 months minimum, will give a lot of people added time, and is a very, you know, it's it's really meager. Like Barry was saying, you know, it's 40% of their income. It's not like anybody is getting rich. They're just trying to get some more time to really find some meaningful work. And while we really appreciate everything that that you guys are doing and that the committee might do, we really think that it's important to change this as a statute so that other employers don't have the same chance to do these kind of things to other families. And it's kind of important.
Thank you. Representative Kinnamer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jessica, one of the things that concerns me here is, and I'm not sure you're the best one to answer this, but in the event that this lockout ends, what percentage of people are likely to not get rehired or to get hired, whichever direction it is? Do we have any way to estimate that number? I mean, it probably will not be 100% will be offered their jobs back. Is that correct?
It would be all speculation, really, on our part.
Yep. Thank you.
The expectation, I think, is that everybody goes back to work. You know?
Really?
Which is what we see in other cases. And I think I would just pivot us back to we're asking for a measly 40% of their income just so that they can make it by, right? And we're really hopeful that the lockout will end. We know that it's rare that they extend beyond 3 months, let alone beyond much more than 6 months.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't know that you were looking down this direction. When we had to, I have a company too, and we had to lay off quite a few people in 2009, and it seems like then it was the unemployment was like 70% of what they had been making, and then and we brought them back for a day a week just to kind of offset that, but it wasn't 40%. It was closer to 65 to 70%, and then it wasn't a six-month window either. I think back then it was at least a year, and then I think they extended it to 2 years. So this unemployment, is this different than what my employees experienced?
So I'm not with the unemployment or with the employment department, but these guys can tell you exactly what they were making previously and what they're making now.
I don't really believe it's the amount. The weekly maximum benefit is only $567 a week. And so considering what we make on an hourly basis, that's why it's so low.
Okay. With overtime. A lot of us work a lot of overtime because they run short-handed. They, you know, employers, they don't want to hire the extra people, so they put in, you know, hey, you know, we need, you know, instead of working 40 hours, work 50 or 60 hours. So then you work that extra hours, and you become accustomed to it.
Representative Bird. I'm sorry, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I did. As far as the company being open right now, do they bring management in to run the company now as far as the jobs you did, or have they hired other people?
They've largely hired folks to come in from out of state. They've been putting them up in a hotel in Salem, paying for them to be bused down to Albany. So that's part of the cost that they were referencing earlier, right? Okay. This is an added cost to this company.
Thank you.
Wow. Representative Hurd.
So could you gentlemen please explain to me, like, percentage-wise what you kind of feel like your unemployment benefit and value has been to what you were normally earning, percentage-wise?
I can tell you my value is about probably 50%.
Okay. Mine's right about 40%.
Mine's actually a little less than that because I work too much.
Yeah. And my comment is I will admit that this last December here when I laid my guys off because we're landscaping and seasonal work for about 3 to 4 weeks, I was amazed at how little unemployment benefit they did. And they just do 40-hour work weeks, but it was in that 40 to 45% range. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Any other questions?
For you. Are we going to have the unemployment department come up, the employment department?
They're not signed up. Do you have a question for them?
Yeah, because I'm just kind of curious on this, because I was thinking when you were locked out that you technically aren't unemployed, or when you strike, I didn't know they could draw benefits. I wasn't sure about all the legalities and then the extension and all of that.
That was mentioned earlier. There was a statute passed in Oregon to provide locked out worker benefits for unemployment. It's
just for the six months. So it's not a normal.
And that was in 07, I think.
Yeah.
But it's not a normal unemployment benefit that they're receiving.
It's a regular unemployment benefit. So, I mean, it's just new. Okay. We're just extending an existing law on this, on unemployment benefits. I don't know if you really want, do you want to, we have a lot of people to get through still.
That's fine. I just thought they might fall under, it'd just be regular where they could have 2 years and things like that.
Yeah.
It's a different statute.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for being here. I will say that, you know, I spent a little bit of time on strike myself once for about a month. I can't imagine going 6 months. And my heart goes out to you. I wish we could do more. I wish we could sneak in an amendment into this that would require ATI to pay your mortgage payments.
Second that.
Yeah. Car payments and a few other things. It's really aggravating. I know a little bit about this, and you know, it's just uncalled for. So thank you very much. I don't see anyone else signed up to testify. There's no opposition signed up, I will note, on this bill. So I'm going to close the public hearing. We're going to stand at ease for a few minutes.
It's more like poop, so that's
a humor running low at the moment.
I'd like to bring the committee back to order. We're under a public hearing on 4086. There is no more testimony left. In case I didn't close it, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4086 and open a work session on House Bill 4086. Representative Barton.
Chair Hovey, I move that House Bill 4086 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 4086 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the recess. I know time is of the essence, and frankly, having unemployment benefits go away in 10 days is a very difficult situation for all of us, frankly, those of us that have to make a decision. We've also had the disadvantage that our member, who is the chief co-sponsor of this bill, has been away due to a family death and has not been able to brief the Republican caucus on this matter, and this is a difficult matter for, frankly, Republicans. I think we've had a little discussion. I think we are persuaded that this is an extraordinary and unusual case, and we would like to extend a yes vote as a caucus on this matter. We may reconsider it before the floor vote, but I suspect I think one of the things that we are concerned about is this is an extraordinary case, and perhaps we think a sunset should be put on the bill so it's not automatic given, because then that does create a difference in the leverage. But in the short term, we're very sympathetic and very concerned for your well-being, and we think this is a prudent matter. I guess, Mr. Biden.
Other comments?
Yes.
Representative White.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, and I'm very supportive, as Representative Kinnemer was saying, on this, knowing your situation and everything, and would like to see a sunset on this so we can take care of you, but not to where it's in statute or in law permanently. And I'm a little concerned that the chair does not want to even take any of this on and just wants to be in statute permanently when it should be something where we deal with this situation and we look at it when the next situation comes along. But I'm going to be a courtesy yes out of this committee. We'll see what happens as it goes through Ways and Means, but it's something that shouldn't be in statute permanently. It should have a sunset so you guys have the benefits you need to start looking for work or moving on and doing what you need to. Just would really like to see a sunset on it, and I think I speak for every member up here on the Republican side, that we think there should be a sunset on these benefits.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I strongly disagree with that. I think that having the 12-month piece in statute permanently would perhaps be a deterrent from this happening again, and I don't want to have to come back if this were to happen in the future at a different company and have to reconsider this again. I think it would serve a good purpose for it being in statute, so I strongly disagree with that contention. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. I appreciate, again, you can see some different perspectives here. I just want to be clear. I don't think it's just the chair who feels that way. I think there are a great many of us, and certainly probably a very sizable majority, I think, of our chamber perhaps agrees with the chair in this case. Sometimes when you make a change, it feels like a bigger deal than it really is. I think in this case, the only reason why this is not already in statute is just because lockouts is so rare. We really haven't had the opportunity to consider this before. I don't think this is going to be a big change, and I think, frankly, this is long overdue. And I feel very comfortable proceeding without a sunset.
Other comments? Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I wouldn't totally agree with that because I think strikes are the leverage for the employee, and I think the lockout, even though I don't know much about it, seems to be the leverage for the employer. And it seems like in this committee, since I have been here, it has been fairly one-sided, and it has been against the employer and for the employee, and the next bill we're hearing this morning will be the same thing. And so I am not totally in agreement with that. As a matter of fact, I was a courtesy yes on this, but only because of the situation here and Andy Olson, who's the sponsor of this bill. And so, no, I hate to see the teeth get taken away from anything that goes for the employer regardless. Now, there's good employers and there's bad employers, and I don't know for a fact who this employer is. I don't know much about him. But to see all of the teeth get taken away from the ability for the employer to make decisions is wrong.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment. I think, one of the reasons we're in this room is we're to make difficult decisions and to try and use our best judgment. And I'm a psychologist by trade, retired now, but I remember my marriage counseling professor had what I think was phenomenal advice for me many years ago. He said, you'll do a better job if you remember all people are basically incompatible. And when you look at the world, you see the world differently, and there are a lot of different eyes. And the genius of our system of government is that we can disagree and agree, and we put forth products. And by gum, this is probably going to go sailing. Well, this is going to go sailing out of this committee, going to go on the floor, I think sail through the floor. And they will have, I think, a vibrant discussion on the other side and do whatever the heck they think is best. And then we'll either agree with it, or they will agree with us and it'll be done, or and go to the governor, or they will disagree with us and we'll have a little further discussion. But it shall be solved. And I think we're at a good point, ask for the question. Call for the question.
We had other people
still
in the queue.
I withdraw. Excuse me. My enthusiasm, I aired because I think people ought to have the right to say what they darn well please.
I was Representative Evans, you've been quiet, and I wanted to make sure you had an opportunity to speak. Thank you.
I am. Thank you, Chair. And again, I really do respect all the opinions up here. I want to say something to the folks that came. Number one, thank you for coming and sharing this situation. These are rare, as Representative Barton said. But my concern and the reason that I'm in support of this, strong support, is I don't think it's going to be as rare in the future as we grapple with how to build the 21st century economy. And I think that anything we can do to encourage both sides finding a way for profitability in the future is a good thing. And I think that the state saying we're going to make sure that the workers caught in the middle are taken care of is the right message. So I just appreciate this bill coming forward, and I look forward to the floor discussion. And again, at the end of the day, we can talk about sunsets in the future, but the fact that folks that through, really in this particular case, no fault of their own, were denied the opportunity to earn and work and, quite frankly, that the owners of this particular business put the community at greater risk because of the materials they use, put in hands of people that weren't necessarily trained, has been a significant concern to me. So I'm very, very grateful to actually be a part of this particular vote, and grateful that it's going to be moving out of here on more than just a party line vote.
Thank you. And though I appreciate all the comments, I do recognize that there is a difference between a lockout and just a strike. And so in a lockout situation, especially when you have a employer that's breaking federal law, you know, I just don't have a lot of sympathy for him. So with that, Ashley, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Guerrero?
Courtesy, yes.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Courtesy, yes.
Representative Evans?
Absolutely, yes.
Representative
Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Noakes?
Absolutely, yes, for me, too.
Representative
Widener? Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinnemer?
Aye.
Chair Holt?
Aye. House Bill 4086, having received the required votes, is passed.
Mr. Chair, in terms of carrier, Representative Rayfield is absolutely in the event.
Yeah, I already did. He says get it for both sides. Now I may have to.
Oh, it's pushed away from me.
So, yes, we will have...
forget, we don't need to carry. My mistake.
Still got to get through.
Yeah, it's going to Ways and Means.
Hey, employment guys. Thanks for doing the work to make this more legal.
Thank you. It's true. It's
true.
Hey, absolutely. Thank you, guys. You guys are the one, actually. They would
reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4088.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure prohibits discrimination in employment on the basis of familial status of the employee, and you have no amendments before you.
All right. Up first, I don't know what order. You've got orders down here, but I need to bring up three people, if possible. Carla Peluso, John Bartholomew, and Salim Narani. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, good morning, Chair Holby and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, representative for House District 50, Gresham, and a small portion of Portland. You all will recall that I was here during January legislative days providing a briefing on House Bill 4088, Employment Protections for Familial Status, otherwise known as Off-Duty Caregiving Responsibilities. As a reminder, House Bill 4088 will ensure that employees are not discriminated against at work or for their off-duty familial responsibilities. Familial status discrimination is simply discrimination in the workplace based on an employee's real or perceived responsibility to care for family members. Currently, employers may discriminate based on familial status by denying employment or promotions, paying less, or otherwise taking negative employment action against an employee because of the employee's real or perceived responsibility to care for family members. So what does caregiver discrimination actually look like? Passing over highly qualified mothers for hire or promotion in favor of less qualified fathers or women without children. Firing or demoting employees whose spouses or elderly parents become disabled for fear of increased absenteeism or higher health insurance premiums. Firing or demoting employees whose spouses or elderly parents become disabled for fear of increased, for increased absenteeism or higher insurance premiums. Harassing or penalizing workers who take time off to care for their aging parents or sick spouses or partners. House Bill 4088 will ensure that employees across the state will be protected from familial status discrimination in the same way they are protected against employment discrimination based on sex, race, religion, disability, national origin, and age. For the majority of Oregon businesses, which overwhelmingly understand the unique challenges faced by employees with caregiving responsibility, this bill will not change how they do business. House Bill 4088 will not create a separate line item to a business balance sheet or budget, does not require businesses to provide additional benefits to employees, and does not force businesses to allow an employee to work fewer hours than is normally expected. House Bill 4088 will serve to protect the employees of only those few businesses that choose to discriminate against employees with family responsibilities, so employees are judged by their performance, not their off-duty caregiving responsibilities. The boss is still the boss. This bill does not require employers to provide any benefits. It doesn't prevent employers from hiring, promoting, or firing any employee based on performance or business needs, but it does prevent them from discriminating against an employee because of their off-duty caregiving responsibilities. This concept isn't new. Seven jurisdictions in Oregon have enacted familial status protections that go beyond state and federal law and expressly prohibit employment practices that target people with family responsibilities. Those jurisdictions are Beaverton, Corvallis, Eugene, Hillsborough, Portland, Salem, and Benton County. They all have specific employment protections against familial status discrimination. While existing laws and local ordinance cover the vast majority of workers in Oregon, they leave several gaps around the state and, now this is really important, they do not explicitly cover elder care. This patchwork of policies leaves employers in many situations having to guess how the courts will interpret existing laws when caregiver discrimination is at issue. Often, employers don't know that they can't discriminate against mothers and end up facing expensive lawsuits. A definite law is needed to remove this uncertainty for Oregon employers. House Bill 4088 would create a clear and consistent statewide standard to protect against caregiver discrimination. This protection would operate and be enforced in the same manner as existing employment protections in Oregon's civil rights laws. In addition, House Bill 4088 would define familial status to encompass all types of caregiving relationships, including children, parents, grandparents, non-traditional family members, and another person who is dependent on the employee for care. Our economy, workplaces, and families are changing, yet workplaces still operate like it is still the 1950s. More and more Americans are shouldering elderly and family care responsibilities. About half of the United States workforce expects to be providing elder care in the coming 5 years. Our workplaces need to become more adaptive to the current reality of families and their changing responsibilities. If we don't, Oregon employers will miss out on an incredible talent and our economy will suffer. House Bill 4088 will help by simply requiring employers to give employees with off-duty caregiving responsibilities equal treatment under the law. This is an issue of basic fairness. Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee, for this opportunity to speak to this important issue.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. And I'm here today to just talk a little bit about why we support this legislation. And it is largely because of its support for family caregivers. In Oregon, there are approximately 460,000 Oregonians who provide some level of care to an adult loved one every year. This can be anything ranging from just help around the house, help with shopping on weekends, or mowing the lawn, to more difficult things like activities of daily living, bathing a parent, things that are a lot more stressful as well. But there's a wide range of things that people do that is worth approximately $5.5 billion of unpaid care each year if it was being paid for through private pay or the Medicaid system. So we want to make sure that this natural support system
is supported and not discriminated against. Many individuals providing care are still in the workforce, juggling the need to work to pay their bills while trying to help a parent or spouse or other close family member with their care needs. Indeed, some of them are part of the sandwich generation that are taking care of a parent and a child or children at the same time. And obviously still performing well in their employment. So no hardworking Oregonian should have to fear they may lose their job or be discriminated against simply because they're providing care for a loved one. In addition, employers should not be discriminating against qualified job applicants on the basis of that applicant being a care provider outside of the workplace. Right now, there's a patchwork of non-discrimination laws, as the representative mentioned, and in many, it's unclear whether caregiving for an adult is covered by some of those laws. And this would create a clear statewide standard to ensure that family caregivers do not face employment discrimination. And that is the reason why AARP Oregon is in support of this legislation. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Salim Narani, a small business owner with liquor stores in Corvallis and Springfield. I'm here today to testify in support of HB 4088 as an AARP member, volunteer, as well as a small business owner. I currently have a staff of 4 to 5 employees in each location, working either part-time or full-time. A statewide law granting employees the right of familial status is the ethical thing to do. In my 30-plus years as an entrepreneur and a small business owner, I've learned that the employees are the heart and soul of a business. The success of any retail business depends greatly on the quality of interaction between an employee and a retail customer. A happy employee will generally interact positively with the customers. Being able to provide employees with quality benefits and not penalize them for taking time off to take care of close family members is a critical component of well-being and mindset of an employee. For years now, I have provided this as a benefit to my employees and will continue to do so. There's a patchwork of city regulations regarding familial status. For example, in Corvallis, the city ordinance requires that the employers provide this as a benefit, while Springfield does not address this issue. I believe it is unfair to an employee, given their geographical location, as to their employment rights of being able to take care of family members without being discriminated against. The inclusion of familial status in HB 4088 will provide a clear and defined guideline for both the employers and employees. In Oregon, there are approximately 460,000 people providing some level of unpaid care for an adult loved one. They provide about $5.5 billion a year in unpaid care and are the foundation for Oregon's system of long-term supports and services. Supporting caregivers support Oregon's economy and reduces the demand on state-funded services. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I urge you to vote positively for this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions for this panel? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 17, 15 through 17 of this bill, it says a family member means an individual who is dependent on an employee for their support or care. I guess I'd like that defined a little better. Does that mean a neighbor who needs help?
No. It says family member.
On the bill, it says an individual who is dependent on an employee for their support or care. And this is under a family member means. Do you see it?
That's correct.
Yeah, so it could be a neighbor.
Yes.
So it could be anybody on your block.
Yes.
So it could just be anybody.
Yes.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
You know, I guess I struggle with this bill as an employer. I mean, we have, in my business, we have let mothers come in with new babies. You know, you give your time off. We give time off pretty reasonably. There are times, though, that you have a job that requires someone to be there or it shuts down production, and you can get by one or two days. But if it's habitual and you need a full-time employee, how does this work around that?
Well, Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, again, as I stated in the statement, the boss is still the boss. And what this bill does just does not allow treatment for one person to be different in a similar situation to be different than the other.
Does this, may I follow up?
Follow up.
Does this open up then the opportunity for litigation, discriminatory litigation, against the employer because there's a comparison then between one person who doesn't need that because he doesn't have that need out in his family to take care, and then another one who does, and they can't put in the same amount of time, they can't put in the same amount of hours, they can't dedicate themselves to the job that the employer is requiring them to do. And so what I'm saying is, if the job that the employer hired them to do requires 5 days a week at 8 hours a day, and they can't meet that because they have to take care of a member, and so they can't meet that requirement, and so then they get laid off or fired because they can't meet that requirement of 40 hours a week, is that discrimination?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, I will defer that to the lawyers in the room. As far as litigation, I don't have an understanding of what that would entail.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hurd, quick question. I'm keeping an eye on the clock a little bit.
Mr. Chair, because I have kind of a similar question. Is there another panel coming that will be more thoroughly able to answer that?
Probably.
Okay. I'll wait then. Yes.
Other questions? This panel? Thank you, Representative, for bringing this up. I think it is a topic that deserves a look.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for waiting, okay. Representative. The worst chairs in any committee I'm in.
Up next, Emily McLean. Is it Sarai Johnson? Or?
Trying to lock him in.
Boy, I'm getting better. Kate Newall and Krishina Stephenson. I don't know if you all want to come up or you want to just wait. That's fine.
So we're just hanging for
yeah, sure. Good morning. Just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chairs Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Emily McLean, and I'm here on behalf of Basic Rights Oregon. Basic Rights Oregon is our state's leading advocacy group working to ensure that all lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Oregonians experience equality. We support House Bill 4088 and believe that no worker should be discriminated against because of their family caregiving responsibilities or familial status. Basic Rights Oregon is glad to see full an inclusive definition of familial status in House Bill 4088. We believe this is a critical aspect to this legislation to ensure that Oregon families are fully reflected in these protections. LGBTQ folks are often shunned by blood family relatives in society. Their families can form under a variety of trying circumstances. LGBT-identified older adults in the U.S. are twice as likely as non-LGBTQ-identified seniors to live alone and more than four times as likely to be childless. Therefore, LGBTQ older adults are less likely to have family support when they need care and often rely on families of choice or support networks that are comprised of close relationships that are equivalent to family. Consider Ewan's story. This is a member of Basic Rights Oregon and supporter. Ewan says, I was born and raised in Malaysia, but came to the U.S. so that I could safely express my sexual orientation, gender identity, and political beliefs. Separated by my blood family by 8,000 miles, I have created a strong chosen family in Portland. That chosen family celebrated with Ewan when they became a U.S. citizen 3 years ago, took care of them, and Ewan says, when they're recovering from gender transition surgery, those folks are named in their living will and are noted in their health care directives. More than 18% of Americans, or 57 million people, live in multi-generational family households, double the number who lived in such households in 1980. This figure is higher among communities of color. Among about one in four Latinos and African Americans live in a multi-generational household, and 27% of Asian Americans do. Family structures in our state and across the country have changed and are changing. Policy needs to reflect how our families live and who our families are. We believe that House Bill 4088 does that. We would encourage your support of House Bill 4088 to protect employees across the state from caregiver discrimination and give employers a consistent standard. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Sarai Johnson, and I'm the mother of two boys. I live in Eugene, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. During both of my pregnancies, I worked in a professional upper management position at a regional nonprofit, was based in Springfield. When I became pregnant with my second child, I was the second in command with the organization, yet my boss made comments such as, "Are you going to be a stay-at-home mom now?" and other things that felt threatening to me. I felt obligated to overcompensate for my pregnancy, and I worked about 60 to 80 hours a week. As my due date approached, I needed time for rest for myself and the baby, and I was able to take the time off, but my request was met with hostility, and I knew my boss didn't like it. I left work for maternity leave about 3 weeks before my due date, as I had signs of early labor and was concerned for the health of my baby. It was clear that my boss was not happy that I was taking the time off, and because of her veiled threats and antagonism, I ended up working from home almost full-time in that period. I was very concerned about my ability to keep my job, and as a result, I went back to work when my baby was only 1 week old and full-time when he was 2 weeks old. When I'd been back to work a few weeks, my boss significantly changed my duties, though I kept my title and salary. Again, I felt not only unsupported but threatened. I went to work every day with my baby, in spite of the growing sense of hostility I faced from my boss, who both wanted me there and resented my newborn for being with me in the office. When my baby was 8 weeks old, the organization made a policy change. No more babies in the office. I had to scramble to find a nanny, which was an expense I had not planned, and she took my baby nearly full-time for 4 weeks until he could go to daycare at 12 weeks. My experience of hostility and impatience, disdain and frustration from my boss and other management during this time was in contrast to the experience a coworker had around the same time, which was related to her own health. She was diagnosed with cancer and in response was given an open door for scheduling her appointments and taking extended leave, during which time she was not expected to work from home. Of course, I felt this was fair and entirely appropriate, and although I was aware of the stark difference in our experiences. Circumstances continued to be tense at work as my baby grew into a toddler, particularly when it came time for me taking time off to care for him if he were sick or his brother when they were ill. While it was begrudgingly allowed, taking time off to care for my sick kids was always looked upon with disdain and was generally frowned upon. In the fall of 2014, after 6.5 years with the company, I finally chose to leave, in no small part because I didn't feel my family caregiving needs could be accommodated without a continuous fight and risk to my standing and position. Too many women are treated with hostility and threats at work when they have children. A familial status discrimination law could go a long way toward improving working conditions, and I share this painful experience with you today in the hope of making things better for other women.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Not seeing any questions. Thank you so much for being here today. Up next, Kate Newhall and Stephenson.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, here today representing Family Forward. We are happy to be here today offering testimony in support of House Bill 4088. Family Forward supports protecting workers from discrimination based on their off-duty caregiving responsibilities or their familial status. We don't believe that any worker should ever be treated differently based just on their familial obligations that occur outside of the workplace. We are an organization that is committed to advancing policies that support families and help them succeed both at the workplace and at home. Our mission is to create a family-friendly Oregon where all families can be economically secure and successful at work and still meet their families' caregiving needs. Today, we feel like too many families are sacrificed to choose between one or the other, and we support family-friendly policies like these employment protections for caregivers. I think you just heard some examples of how familial status discrimination can happen. I just wanted to give a couple more examples because I think kind of anticipating Representative Barreto and Representative Hurd's questions, I think what this bill is really about is making sure that we treat employees equally in the workplace. It's not about granting them extra treatment or extra provisions. It's about making sure that you treat employees equally and fairly. So, for example, an example of this would be if you as an employer grant an employee Tuesday and Thursday afternoons off so that they can play on an indoor soccer league, and you allow them to make up those hours somewhere else in the week or at home. And you don't allow a similar employee to have a similar flexible schedule because they have childcare obligations that they have to meet and pick up. So again, this isn't about requiring that an employer grant something differently. It's just that you treat employees the same and that you don't discriminate against them. Another example might be demoting or firing employees who have spouses or elderly parents that they're taking care of that have been disabled because you anticipate that they're going to have higher absenteeism or higher health insurance premiums. Another example might be passing over more highly qualified mothers for promotion in favor of less qualified fathers or women without children. So those are just a couple examples that I wanted to highlight about how this type of discrimination happens and we see it. And we know that discrimination against caregivers, and mothers in particular, exacerbates the wage gap. Mothers are less likely to be hired and are offered lower salaries than women without children and fathers. In addition, mothers earn 5% less per child than non-mothers, even when this is statistically controlled for education, work experience, and other variables. More and more Americans are shouldering elder care and family care responsibilities. More than half of the U.S. workforce expects to be providing elder care in the coming 5 years. And most of our family caregivers, about 66% of them, are women. And lower-income women carry a particularly high caregiving burden. 52% of women caregivers with incomes less than $35,000 a week spend 20 hours a week providing care. I think, as you heard before, we do have a patchwork of laws here in Oregon. I think there are also a patchwork, and I think Ms. Stephenson is going to talk a little bit more to this. Stephenson. Thank you, Chair Holby. But I think we have a patchwork of local jurisdictions that have a similar sort of familial status protection in existence already. Unfortunately, those don't likely cover elder care. I think there are also a number of other sort of legal theory approaches that you can get at sort of this caregiver discrimination already under existing law. But I do think that leaves a lot of gaps and leaves out protections for a lot of Oregon workers. Some workers have been able to bring successful suits under existing sex discrimination laws or under family medical leave laws when they have been discriminated against for their caregiving responsibilities. Unfortunately, it does leave many gaps. Combined with the local ordinance, it also creates a patchwork that I think leaves employers in many situations guessing how the courts will interpret existing laws when caregiver discrimination is at issue. I also think employers don't often know that they can't discriminate against mothers and end up facing lawsuits. I think we should have a more definitive law that removes some of the uncertainty for these employers. We also think that the expanded definition of family member is important because we do have a lot of people who are providing care who may not be their blood relatives. They may be a neighbor. They may be a sister or a brother that you're providing care for that wouldn't be otherwise covered just under the definition of family member. So for those reasons, we do not only support House Bill 4088, but the expanded definition of how it approaches who is a family member that you would be protected in employment for providing this type of care to. So thank you for the opportunity to bring this important issue forward. We think discrimination on familial status hurts mothers, caregivers, and the families who rely on them. Eliminating this type of discriminations will help families better care for each other and allow women and caregivers to be treated equally in the workplace. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is Christina Stevenson. I'm an employment attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. The association has a number of members that fight for workers who face discrimination in the workplace, and that's why our members support HB 4088. So the bill really is really simple. It simply recognizes that in addition to reasons such as race, religion, sex, an employee's familial status is just not a legitimate reason to make employment decisions. Employers still will have the ability to make business decisions, and this doesn't change that. It just eliminates discrimination. And I know there's some questions, so I'd be happy to take questions.
Questions of this panel? Looks like we are delighted. First, Mr. Hurd, and then Representative Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hurd, excuse me.
I have a couple questions, if I may. So, first one deals with hours. So,
I'm mindful of time. We actually do have one more panel. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Are we going to have another public hearing on this bill?
Unfortunately, I'd be the last to know.
Aren't you the chair?
Temporarily. So, so please, we're mindful of time. We'll try and.
I'm a very small company. Okay, I have two full-time employees pretty much year-round and one part-time. I mean, this is not a hypothetical. This is me. Now, the hypothetical part, though, is let's say my part-time employee that I have is childless, wants full-time hours, but I can only afford to give him or her 20 hours at the moment, while the other two are getting 40 hours every week. But number two employee at full-time is starting to show consistent needs for absence. It could be one day, 2 days a week. Thus, at some point, because of scheduling conflicts and different issues, at some point I have to make the business decision that I can't continue to scramble to try to pull this other person. The person at 20 hours is an ambitious, hardworking person. They want to get full-time work. At some point, I'm gonna lose them if I don't promote them to the point of where, hey, you're going to be here consistently, 5 days a week. You're now the person. Is that discrimination based on, so let's say the reason number two could not be there all the time was because their mother had fallen ill or they, those kinds of circumstances. Is that discrimination? It's a business decision to me that has to be made at some point because I'm losing money and the whole crew is being thrown into a tailspin all the time because of this consistent hiccup in the road that's now developed.
So I'll take a stab at it, and I'll also let Ms. Stevenson take a stab at it. In my mind, I think what we would look at is, are you treating all of those employees equally? So I think if you are not granting regularly any of your employees a flexible schedule, you're not under a requirement to grant this other particular employee a flexible schedule. Is your...
That sounds like it could be just left up to whoever's in charge of making the final decision's opinion on the matter. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's really set in stone, clear for me as an employer. What about from the follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Promotions. So I've got two great people, love them dearly, want them to both do well, but one of them is not able, because of family circumstances, to be there more than 30 hours a week. The other person can be there 40 or 50 hours a week, and I need somebody to be a manager. Equal skill, equal everything. The difference is one is childless or does not have these problems that take them away from work consistently. The other one does. So simply from that decision, I promote the one that doesn't have those issues. Am I going to be putting myself in harm's way now? Because I don't, before you answer, I have no idea how in the heck I'm supposed to run a company from a logical standpoint if that is discrimination.
And is it possible to do a brief reply? That's okay.
Every situation is going to be different, and I don't know that I have enough information.
Yes or no.
To say, would I take the case? No. Okay. I mean, I think that's what I could say about it. The point of the bill is not to remove the ability for employers to make business decisions, and that's not what it does. It just takes that sort of illegitimate reason that if these employees are performing the same, it doesn't matter what's going on in their home life. That's all it does.
I have to make, please allow me to make.
Chair Holby's back to the gavel.
Rep Evans, or did you have a follow-up? We're running a little bit long here, so
I understand. to me, it doesn't. I appreciate that people have to take care of people, but they're clearly no longer equal because of performance, and I need full performance, and one is only able to give me partial performance because of their extenuating circumstances. It's not that I have anything against them. It's a business decision, and it seems to me that this is pretty clear that it would put me in a position where somebody could accuse me, because I am discriminating against them, essentially, in my business decision. There's no malicious intent, but I have to make a determination on who is going to be what for what reason, and that's the reason. They can't be there. It really doesn't matter to me why they can't be. They can't be there, but it can easily be said I made that choice because of family obligations.
Chair Holvey, Representative Hurd, I think you as an employer can still make employment decisions based on work performance.
And part of work performance can include the ability to be at work. So if a person can't be at work, that is a legitimate business decision. You can't. The job requires 30 hours. You can't do 30 hours. And if you're not taking into why they can't do the hours, that's kind of the point. You're not taking into account this person's got elder care responsibilities. The other person has dog care responsibilities. I'm not looking at that. I'm looking at the hours, which I need to get this job done.
Thank you. Other questions? Rep. Evans?
I have three yes or no questions.
Great. I love those.
Attorneys don't have yes or no questions.
If they can't do yes or no on this one, then they're sunk. So here we go. Number one, this clarifies ambiguity in the existing patchwork and the existing interpretations. Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes or no? The city of Salem actually has familial policies already on the books, so this isn't inventing something wholly out of new cloth.
Yes.
Number three, the intent of this is actually to make sure that the changes provide clarity so that potentially people might not actually go onto public service care because their actual families could take care of those responsibilities. So this might actually save the state money.
Yes.
Thank you.
Other questions?
So much better than mine.
Thank you for those yes answers.
Yes.
And thank you.
Up next, Betsy Earls and Anthony Smith. And Representative Barreto, did you want to go down or you want to just stay at the... Okay. Good morning. It's good to see you here today.
Glad to be here.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Yes. Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barton, and Vice Chair Kinnemer. Greg Barreto, House District 58, and also CEO of Barreto Manufacturing. And I want to make this short because we're running out of time. But I feel like in this state we are drilling down into the minutiae of rules and regulations. And I think in Oregon, you know, here we're running against the minimum wage issue, and as we've heard last year, in the high cost of low-wage jobs, we need medium-wage jobs. And we are making it very difficult for businesses outside of this state to desire to come into this state because of these very things that we are drilling down on now. And I just want to give you just a short little description here of Idaho's discrimination laws. Race, religion, color, sex, national origin, disability, age 40 and above, and retaliation. And this is Oregon's. And Oregon has the longest one currently of any state in the union. Race, religion, color, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, national origin, marital and familial status, age 18 and above, disability, expunged juvenile record, pregnancy, childbirth, and related medical conditions, injured workers, retaliation, requiring submission to breathalyzer tests, lie detector, genetic testing, psychological stress test, use of legal tobacco during non-working hours, person with a degree in theology or religious occupations, victims of domestic violence or sexual crimes, credit history, testifying at unemployment compensation hearings, leave to attend a criminal proceeding, military service. You know, this list goes on and on. You know, and what we're doing is we're creating an environment here in Oregon that outside businesses don't even have us on the radar. I came here to this job to try and make this state a more business-friendly state, and it seems like since I've been here, we are headed in the opposite direction. So just that's just my message. So thank you for hearing me out.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, and appearing before you in opposition to House Bill 4088. I know we talked about this bill last session quite a bit. I remember those conversations actually in great detail, but let me just go over a few of the problems that we have with the bill today as it appears before you again. House Bill 4088 creates a new protected class in Oregon employment law on top of the list that Representative Barreto has already gone through with you. And that is a class of people whose familial status makes them either real or potential caregivers. And that is exactly where our biggest heartburn comes in, with the real or potential caregivers, because just about everybody in this room has the potential to become a caregiver, even if the law as, or even if the statute, the bill as it's written, only dealt with family members specific to your actual family. All of us have the potential to become a family member. It's not an immutable, quantifiable characteristic in the way some of our other anti-discrimination laws are written. And the definition of family member in House Bill 4088 actually goes far beyond what a person's actual family is into an individual who is dependent on an employee for care. And as was pointed out earlier, that could be just about anybody. So I think besides the fact that we oppose the idea of creating yet another protected class in Oregon, we have a very difficult time with the vague and unquantifiable nature, not only of the potential to become a caregiver, but this new definition of family that the law would put in statute. I can answer questions now or any other time.
Go on.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony K. Smith, Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. I know that we're short on time today, so I'm going to skip through some of the items that we've already heard about and go straight to something that might elaborate on a hypothetical situation that Representative Hurd brought up. Let's say that in my workplace there are frequent opportunities to work overtime, but I can't work the extra hours because of my family obligations as a care provider. But my coworker, on the other hand, who's single and unmarried, works a lot of overtime, and when a promotion becomes available, who gets the job? If all things are equal in terms of performance and seniority, and we're talking about the smallest of small businesses here, and the employer really is in a situation where, it's one or the other. What's the employer supposed to do? Say they try to make the accommodation, because of House Bill 4088. What if I get the job? And because my employer is trying to make that accommodation, I think really the question is wouldn't my coworker maybe have a marital status claim at that point?
No.
Because they've been discriminated against because they are a single and unmarried person, and I'm getting an accommodation based on the law. So, I think a scenario like this, there is a winner and there are two losers, the employee who prevails and the business and the other employee. And I'm not an attorney, and neither are most small business owners. But these are the kinds of questions that are sure to come up at some point, and I think we need to be able to provide them with answers so that they can actually comply with the law. And I think we need to answer those questions before we move the bill. So at this time, I would encourage you to oppose House Bill 4088. Thank you all for answering the questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I got some instructions. Appreciate this. We're not moving this bill at this point, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4088 and adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. Adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.